there isn't some magic that's going to happen inside your digestive system based on what I would call industrial food production. Industrial food production has solved the problems of not enough food or not having enough food consistently throughout a four-season environment. But it's also created a number of foods. So contaminants, dyes, preservatives, you name it. Herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides, I think, are the big elements and probably elements of genetic modification. These are things that are put through all of our food chain at extreme levels, and they have deleterious effects on our digestive system. And the failure to recognize that and make adjustments or make better choices on your daily life, you can just kiss whatever dreams that you have motivated on your regular world goodbye. At some point, that ticking time bomb is going to be disrupted because you didn't pay attention to your health.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As a naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body balance, and inner badass. These are the themes we are exploring. So, what do multiple bodybuilders who have previously been on the Entrepology Podcast have in common? It is that nearly all of them, following a period of intense competition, saw a massive deterioration of their health. Now, think about this. These are athletes performing at their highest level. They are in the most optimized state of physical physique, and yet their body was falling apart on the inside. Today, I am joined by Wade Lightheart. Wade is a former Mr. Universe competitor, three-time Canadian bodybuilding champion, and the co-founder and director of education for Biooptimizers. Wade is the host of his own podcast, the Awesome Health Podcast, and essentially just an absolute wealth of knowledge. He's highly articulate, extremely well-researched in the areas of health optimization, in particular looking at gut health. And it was, in fact, Wade's own journey, one through watching his sister move through deteriorated health, and then his own coming out of this bodybuilding period, that really encouraged him to delve deep into exploring these issues. And what was really enjoyable about the podcast that I recorded today with Wade was the way in which he was able to weave not only a philosophical perspective on health, but some tangible research-focused elements into our conversation related to biohacking from the inside out. So much of Wade's work now focuses on the gut and digestive health issues, because even as Hippocrates said 2,500 years ago, all health starts in the gut. For anyone who is interested in taking their health to the next level, understanding how to optimize your digestive health is where things absolutely must start. And there is no better person to get us started on that conversation than Wade Lightheart himself. And I'm so excited to welcome him to the Entrepology Podcast. Wade Lightheart, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
Megan, great to be here.
I have a lot of questions for you, and I am really excited to get going. But before we jump into that, one thing I really love to know from all of my guests is, how did you get to where you are right now today? I think we often have this plan laid out in our minds, and that's not always how things, not always how they end up. Can you share with our listeners and sort of 60 seconds or less how you got to where you are today in the work that you're doing in health and wellness?
I discovered about the value of health really young when my sister was diagnosed with cancer when I was 15. She was 4 years my senior, and I watched her go through the medical model before she died at the age of 22. So I realized that life and health is not a guarantee. And that kind of set me on my path to study exercise physiology and human performance. And eventually that led to a success in athleticism when I won some Canadian championships. But after that, I literally had a major health crisis after the Mr. Universe contest. I went from Mr. Universe to Mr. Marshmallow, gained 42 pounds of fat and water, and I found a doctor that said, hey, you learned to build the body from the outside in. You didn't learn how to build the body from the inside out. And that set me on a journey to repair my own digestive system. And it turned out there was millions of other people that had the same issue. And we've been doing this ever since.
Yeah. So, okay, great. We have a lot to unpack from that 60-second journey you gave us. And you did it in 48 seconds, by the way. I've had other bodybuilders on the podcast before, and they too suffered really significant internal health crises as they were pursuing, as you put it, sort of an external view on health. Is that common in that industry? Like, I didn't put it all together until you just said that. Now I'm like, huh, this is a thing.
It is. And I'll tell you why. Unfortunately, we have a society that has put performance above health. And what I would say in regards to that is we look at pictures of magazines, we see people on Hollywood, all the kind of what I would say influencers that kind of affect what our perception is. And many of those people are following a performance diet. In other words, they're looking to look a certain way, be a certain way, or perform at a certain level. And bodybuilding is just one aspect. We can look at entrepreneurship. We can look at high performance sports. It doesn't matter. And oftentimes what happens is people are actually sacrificing their health to achieve whatever that is they value as what the performance outcome. In this place, it's cosmetic performance. I want it to look a certain way. And they don't realize the consequences that may be involved in regards to their health. And in the bodybuilding world, it was typically really, really high protein diets and things like that. And, you know, excessive dieting to, you know, what I would call sub-healthy levels of body fat for extended periods of times. And then, of course, then on top of that, you can add a lot of people use performance enhancing drugs and things like that. So all of those things lead to a performance that maybe looks good on paper, but may have consequences and oftentimes has consequences on the health side. That paradigm's starting to change now that people realize that you can't sacrifice your health for performance, but for the most part, most people are.
Yeah, well, and I see that in clinic all the time. We have a whole spectrum of conditions. We call them the conditions of high performance.
That's so true.
And it's exactly those things that you speak to. And I think that the challenge with individuals who are driven is that when you have a good day, you're like, okay, I can just do one more day like this, and I'm going to be able to do one more day like this. And it's a mentality that pushes through, not one that necessarily acknowledges all the signs of one's limitations. Was it your work in bodybuilding and your own health crisis that led to your work that you now do with respect to digestive health?
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, I compromised my digestion and my health through the sport of bodybuilding per se, and then I needed to rebuild it. So in that process, I underwent what I would call took me 3 months to kind of rebuild my digestive health system. And this was way before, this was a long time ago. This was in 2003. People were not talking about enzymes and probiotics and things like that. But that was not in the conversation under most, you know, most forums, I would say, or sources of information. Keep in mind, the internet was pretty small in those days. You know, we didn't have podcasts, like all the kind of the alternative channels that were outside of mainstream medicine didn't exist. And I just happened to get lucky. And having rebuilt that, I had a little holistic health clinic in Vancouver. And I started finding that a lot of other people were suffering from ailments. And I started working on that in order to help them out, and found that some universal applications after, you know, you help about 15,000 people plus, and you start to learn a few things. And now we're up over, I think, 50,000 now. So it's a fun project.
And what was the aha moment where you went, because this was not in an era where we were talking about it, like you said, to the same extent, where you went, huh, the gut is the root cause of all the downstream effects that I had been seeing in my own health and people are seeing in their own health as well.
Well, it was that moment when my mentor said to me, you learn to build the body from the outside in, not from the inside out. And I realized that my knowledge, my information, what I was going to was essentially what I would call a surface knowledge. And the fundamental assumption was, if my body fat's at a certain level and my musculature is at a certain level, then I've achieved success. And that is an external representation. But what was the cost? And I didn't, you know, the basic assumption was, is that everything that goes into my mouth just gets magically digested and turned into either energy units or building blocks. And that is the end of the story. So it was, you know, even though I had learned the basic mechanics of physiology and, you know, kind of a, what I would say a brush over of nutrition, we didn't really look into those things. We didn't understand, and I don't think we understand all of it yet. I think we're entering into the recognition of, you know, the digestive system and how important that is, and why so many people today are compromised. But that was the aha moment. And then the more I got into it, it just become more and more fascinating. You know, as you get into something, you scratch your own itch, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, where do we go with this? And it hasn't let up for 16 years, 15 years, something like that. So.
Well, I just feel like the knowledge we're uncovering literally on a monthly basis with respect to the ramifications of optimized gut health and its influence on a microbiome and epigenetics, it's absolutely fascinating. You mentioned briefly in there this idea of we were focused on these external metrics. And I had a meeting with my clinical team today, and we were saying, you know, we've got to get people away from looking at the scale as their primary motivation in terms of health. What would you say are some of the key metrics that you would want people looking at with respect to their health?
Well, the easiest ones are what I would call internal cues. And I did have this one great fortune of when I was in my competitive days, I was taught the art of observation of my own physiology with my coach. So, you know, and that would be in regards to digestion, these are really simple indicators. Are you bloated? Are you gassy? Right? Do you have heartburn or acid reflux? Do you have diarrhea or do you have constipation? If you have any of those conditions, you can bet that something in your system's not working the way it should, whether that's dietary related or actually the system related. And then on top of that, then you can look at the secondary things. You know, how is my energy levels? How's my mental focus? What is my emotional state? And this one, the mental emotional state, I cannot tell you how many people are on what I would call antidepressants, and has nothing to do with their brain chemistry. It has everything to do with their gut. They're not actually converting protein into the little polypeptide chains that turn on the essential neurotransmitters in their brain. And then they get diagnosed with, you know, a variety of different conditions, and they clean up their diets, they clean up their guts, and all of a sudden they're not feeling depressed anymore. You know, it's really that thing. So I think skin, I think, is a really good indicator. And I think women are more turned on to this than men, per se, is that, you know, they almost have like radar for people who have glowing kind of skin, which is a sign of youthfulness and health and vitality. If your skin's off, chances are you've got some sort of issue going on in your gut as well. Those are the easy indicators.
Yeah, for sure. And when you're working with someone with respect to gut health, because I know people are driving along in their car right now and they're like, ah, crap, I've got some of those. Where do you start with them? Because there's always an option to move towards supplementation. And I want to talk about that because I think in terms of the restoration of gut health, it's extremely valuable. In fact, frankly, I find it's often unavoidable at some stage of remediation. But do you start with diet? Do you start with supplementation? Do you start with testing? Like, what is the sky's the limit? How do you tend to like to approach it?
Well, the first thing is there needs to be an acceptance of reality. You need the person to be able to acknowledge that this is a problem that is going to get worse. And why I want to put this in here, the data from the United States and from the Journal of Gastroenterology, enterology, I always have a trouble with that word, but it's saying that 12% of emergency health visits today are related to gastrointestinal related issues. Okay, 12%. So more than 1 in 10 of people going to hospitals, it's something wrong with their digestive system. That's a crazy number.
Yeah, it's huge.
You know, it's okay. And then you think of, okay, well, what's the big killers, right? We got, you know, heart attacks, cancer, and diabetes. Well, those things don't happen overnight. And Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, and said that all disease starts in the gut. Now, interesting thing, that's 2,500 years ago. How he knew that, I don't know. So the first thing is to recognize is that there isn't some magic that's going to happen inside your digestive system based on what I would call industrial food production. Industrial food production has solved the problems of not enough food or not having enough food consistently throughout a four-season environment. But it's also created a number of foods. So contaminants, dyes, preservatives, you name it. herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides, I think are the big elements and probably elements of genetic modification. These are things that are put through all of our food chain at extreme levels, and they have deleterious effects on our digestive system. And the failure to recognize that and make adjustments or make better choices on your daily life, you can just kiss whatever dreams that you have motivated on your regular world goodbye. At some point, that ticking time bomb is going to be disrupted because you didn't pay attention to your health. So the first thing that people have to accept that is this feedback from their body is important, it's relative, and it's going to increase until you make adjustments. It's your body telling you, hey, what you're currently doing isn't working. You need to change. Now the problem, I think, so the second step, so that's the first thing, acceptance. Second thing, and recognizing the cost of not fixing it. That's part of the acceptance part of it. Two, who are you going to for your advice? Because the average person trying to figure this out on their own is going to wind up taking years spinning their wheels. Because even in the conversation that we're having today, we're going to apply a lot of generalities in order to, you know, push a point forward or to create a sense of urgency for people to get a look at their health or their digestive health particularly. But at the end of the day, everybody's a unique individual and is undergoing a unique life and has unique genetics and epigenetics and all that sort of stuff and microbiome. We go on and on and on about those things. This is where paying a professional like yourself to get some basic testing, have a quick look at your diet, have a quick look at your lifestyle and go, okay, here's the big picture. Now, where do you want to go with it? Because here's where you're going if you don't. And, you know, you deal with all the people who have kind of neglected this area for maybe decades, and now they're paying severe consequences in compromising illness, disease, dysfunction, and sometimes even death. And so the reality is that's the first step. You can never supplement yourself out of a bad diet. Can't do it.
Or a bad relationship.
Correct.
Or a really crummy job you hate. Like that you can't. You can't pharmaceuticalize yourself out of those things either.
And what's interesting is that's what most of society is. I always found it ironic. Now I was a drug-free athlete, but I always find this complete obsession in sports with athletes who are using performance enhancing drugs. Okay. Like, you know, it's always like the bad news that someone tests positive for this or that or whatever. And that's one thing because it's cheating. But then I think of, you take the average person that's going to work at their office job. Well, what performance enhancing drugs are they using to survive their life? How much caffeine are they taking in the morning? Are they taking cough medicine? Are they taking prescription medications? Are they taking antidepressants? Are they having drinks after work? Are they using recreational drugs? Are they on a variety of different medications? Are they on, you know, blood thinners? Are they on, insulin? You could go down the list. And the reality is, I know in the States, and most of the data comes out of the States because they've had overt advertising towards the consumers, is that about 3/4 of the population is on prescription drugs, and that the disability adjusted life expectancy, and that was done by Professor Oshensky in the Journal of the Journal of New England Medicine, was 60 years old. And that means, you know, people are living longer, but they're living longer because they are dependent on a variety of pharmaceutical drugs in order to augment their poor lifestyle. And many of these things are actually correctable by people such as yourself and by providing, intense, specific care towards that person early on so that they can avoid those situations down the road. So if you're on that wheel of what I would call pharmaceutical enhancement, you're just like an athlete that's cheating on their drug program in order to win a gold medal. And your gold medal isn't a gold medal where you're standing in front of, you know, a million people on a podium somewhere. Your gold medal is, you know, how the story you've written about your career, your finances, your relationships, and your place in the world. That's your gold medal. It's the same thing, yet people have checked out of it. And I think that's where the unconscious anger towards those athletes go, is because of that.
Yeah, it's such an interesting
point. Because
they're
really angry at themselves.
I've had literally people come into my practice describing their digestive symptoms, and I will say, how long have they been going on, expecting like 4 months, and then it was just intolerable. I had someone a little while ago, she'd been dealing with it for 22 years. And I said, what was like, what kept you from seeking help? And for a long time is that she didn't know better. So I feel like people often don't know the difference between common and normal. So as soon as you have an ad for it every other day, we've now made it, we've normalized a set of symptoms. But she said mostly she was really just worried I was going to take away coffee and gluten. Yeah. Right. And I was just like, man, because what happens at the back end of that, and you mentioned this, right? You sure, we can live longer on all of these pharmaceuticals. But I think, again, we're looking at the wrong metric. There's no reference there to quality of life. And when you're on 8 different pharmaceuticals to get yourself through the day, and you're worried you're going to go to the bathroom at random times, and you're scared to leave your house, this isn't a quality of life that's going to score very high at all. I'm segueing to a random point that has zero questions for you, Wade. I just agree with you.
No, I love it. No, I love it, because I think this is the conversations that people need to have with themselves today and every day. And I've dealt with so many people who have waited so long to have that, you know, that moment where they've just accepted. Now, I had the advantage. I saw mortality as a teenager with my older sister. And so I got crystal clear that health and life is not a guarantee. And if you get compromised and you have to get inside of that acute care medical model, very invasive, it's not always successful, and it leaves real scars physically and often mentally, and sometimes it can compromise you for the rest of your life. And nobody wants to have those experiences. I mean, I'm grateful that we have it to save people's lives, and it's wonderful, but there is an over-reliance on these items, and people kind of like, oh yeah, well, I'm just going in and I'm getting this organ taken out, or they're gonna, you know, like there's almost this casualness or disidentification with, hey, this is your human body. Most people take better care of their car. They change the oil in the car, they put gas in the car, they wash the car, you know, it needs something, well, right into the mechanic. They have, you know what I mean? Like, you think about it. You know, and you can, like, the car's 30, 50, maybe it's 100 grand even. Well, what's the price to replace your body? It's priceless.
Yeah, I call it last resort medicine.
Yeah, that's good.
Because it really is. It is. And I think we need to look at it that way for us to really acknowledge everyone's place. And people will often say to me, well, is what you are offering, is it alternative to what my doctor's doing? I said, not at all. I find it so ironic people say that. I say, you know what, if you're drowning in a river, Western medicine is highly efficacious at pulling you to shore, resuscitating you, and getting you on your feet. And I practice upstream and around the corner to figure out why you fell in the first place, and then teach you how to swim. And to me, those are not antagonistic roles adjacent to the river, they're complementary roles. And what I hope is that you never get caught in the rapids. And if you do, they are the lifeguard that is there to pull you out. But until we start to acknowledge that and give ourselves a little bit more credit to have autonomy over our own health, then I think we're going to forever have a system that's caught resuscitating people in the rapids.
Well, there's one other piece I think I would add to that, and that is the attention people get from being sick.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that.
So this is something that was taught to me a long time ago, and I think it's one of the biggest points. So, for example, you get sick as a kid, and particularly, you know, people that had maybe parents that were away or not as present as maybe were in earlier times, where we had maybe one provider in one single family. That's not really, you know, it's not really possible for most people in today's economic world. Most families are working. We don't have. But when you're sick, you get extra attention from the school teacher. You get extra attention from, you know, maybe a doctor, and maybe from your parents. And all of a sudden, you can develop an association of love for that. And there's a lot of people that don't actually feel connected unless they're getting attention from sick. And of course, the more complicated that sickness is, the more they get juiced and the less they are likely to get healthy, because their identity becomes wrapped up with being a sick person. And, you know, the doctors don't know what this is. And I've heard this story over and over and over and over again. And so what a lot of people don't realize is they're actually deriving a lot of juice, if you will, from that situation.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up. And I think for a lot of people, that is a really hard reality to swallow. And I had a patient once, and she was the regional chairperson for whatever her chronic illness was. And she was like, I've seen everybody and I can't get better. And I said, listen, I think until you step out of that role, you're not going to get better. And she was really appalled that I would even suggest that. And I said, the challenge for me is you just derive way too much purpose in your life from your illness. And so we need to find a new way of occupying this notion of purpose for you outside of your condition. And she resisted for a really long time and didn't come and see me for a bit. And then she came back and she said she was ready. She got better like 6 months later. But it took her some time to start to identify newfound purpose. And I talk about purpose a lot in my work. And it's interesting because the neurotransmitters that are released when one feels empowered or special related to their illness are the exact same things that get released when one identifies and acts on their purpose in life. The difference being one is self-sustaining and the other is self-limiting. And it's so interesting you say that because it's literally a biochemical feeling that we're chasing. We just don't often have enough, often it's just resources and acknowledgement of our own potential to jump onto a new train. I really love that you brought that up.
It's huge. Everything in life is really a story. Our identity is a story. Our relationships are a story. Our work, our missions, all that sort of stuff is a story. And it's hard to separate our identity and our story. And our identity is kind of a story. And when it gets tied up in around illness, it can be very damaging. And if it gets tied up around an external without taking ownership of our health, it's also very damaging. So it's a very tricky slope that we can find ourselves in, particularly in today's day and age where we're getting bombarded with so many different messages of what it is to be successful, what it is to be healthy, what it is like, you know, we didn't have these issues. You know, 100 years ago when you literally knew 100 people in your village and that was, you maybe went to, you know, 20 miles away once or twice a year, you know, we just didn't have the same amount of information and that can become confusing. And of course, you never know what your brain's going to latch onto and that does become your reality.
Absolutely. So how would you define health?
Ooh, that's a great one. Health to me is when all of the body's systems and processes are flowing almost like an elegant orchestra in optimal levels and potency in the human body.
Oh, I like that. I like the inclusion of orchestra there because it's so true. And if we are to assume that accessing that state of orchestral balance, it's not even a word, really starts with the gut. So, you know, back to this idea of we acknowledge the fact that there's an issue and you went through a series of symptoms, which is exactly what they are, that people should be on alert towards, that they are common but not normal, the bloated, the gassy, the constipation, the diarrhea, any of those. Can we talk about some of the interventions to start to remedy those? Because just like that person who was scared to come and see me for 20 years because she had blown out of proportion what was going to happen to her if we started to address her health, I think for a lot of people there is there's a lot of misinformation around what it actually takes to start to restore optimal digestion, and frankly, what optimal digestion even looks like. Where do we start? We've got the symptoms. We've acknowledged that they are there. Is it testing people should look to? I mean, I have my own ideas, but I mean, you are so entrenched in this world. I'd love your perspective as well.
Well, I think the first one is it's like anything else. You need an accountability process. And the best, there's, you know, no matter who you go see as a professional or whatever you listen to, at the end of the day, you're the, you know, if they see you once every 2 weeks or something like that, well, guess what? Who's accountable the rest of that time? You are, right? The person is. So I always say get a journal out. And just track how you feel first after everything that you eat. And you're going to find some inflammatory agents right there. Most people, you ask them, what's their diet like? And they say, oh, I eat pretty good. They write down their journal for 2 weeks and they're appalled.
True.
You know, you know, it's like, oh my God, I didn't think I ate this bad, right? Yeah, it's horrible. So that's first thing. So find the inflammatory agents right off the bat. Usually just off a simple elimination, things that you know that you shouldn't do. Oftentimes become illustrated when you actually track the feeling with the food or the event. And that's a big aha, because a lot of people, the thing about our bodies, as soon as we recover from something, we forget about what caused it. You know, if you had a headache, you have a headache for 2 days, it goes away the next morning. You're like, oh, great. I don't have that headache. You don't even remember that you had a headache the day before. It's a really interesting component of the human condition. And that's why being accountable is first. Second thing, I think, The foundation is always, you know, and this is, a lot of people are wary of this, but you need to go on a restriction diet of some sort. And what I mean by restriction is you need to restrict the most inflammatory elements of your life. So if you're knocking back, you know, industrialized margaritas with, you know, cold cuts on gluten bread and you feel like crap every time after, you probably should stop doing that. You know, it's like, it's not that difficult.
I'm sitting here going, that's so extreme. And I know someone's driving me right now being like, how do you know I drink those margaritas every night? Yeah, I find dairy, soy, wheat, and eggs. Those are the four most common culprits I have come across in the last 15 years of practice.
Yeah, and I would agree with you on that. Those are really big contaminants. But I think on the long term, some areas that people don't think of, I believe, is herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides, which are prevalent in a lot of our food. And they disrupt enzymatic processes in those bugs, and that's how they kill them. And they also disrupt our microbiome, and they can also lead to things like, you know, leaky guts and things like, and then preservatives and dyes. So any of the industrialized foods, the more industrialized the food is, probably the more difficult it's going to be for you to digest. You know, if you go to the highest levels of, let's say, dietary expertise, and keep in mind, my business partner is a keto guy and I'm a, you know, plant-based guy, right? I'm a vegetarian. We're at the extreme levels. But what's interesting is when you get to the highest levels of comparison, and I always look at what are the commonalities between things as opposed to the differences, almost everybody says is get your food in as close to as a whole and natural, organic, non-modified state as you can get.
Fair enough. And so as you're listening to this, I'm like, okay, if we have herbicides and fungicides and all of those classic culprits on food, and it's disrupting enzymatic function, I mean, it's naturally going to disrupt the microbiome in the gut. I clinically, and I would love for you to disagree with me, but you know, whatever happens, I don't want people on enzymes long-term necessarily. Like, my goal is, how do we get your body to do this on its own? Would you contend that in unless we are completely eliminating any kind of industrial accessed or mass-produced vegetables or herbicide-laden stuff, that we actually should be supplementing in enzymes?
I'll get into the theory behind this, and I'll go back to Dr. Edward Hall, who was kind of the godfather of enzymatic research way back in the day. And so his work was discovered by a friend of mine, Victoris Kolvinskas, in the Harvard library at one point. It was a pretty interesting story. But bottom line is this. Dr. Hall, of course, exists around the 30s and 40s, 20s, 30s and 40s. It was kind of his heyday when he was doing this research. And he came up with a theory that the length of an organism's life is correlated to the amount of enzymes they had present in the body. So, for example, when you're born, you're very enzymatic rich. And just for people listening, if they know what an enzyme is, they're involved in every single chemical process from thinking to blinking. There's over 25,000 different enzymatic processes that have already been identified by science, and there's probably, you know, an infinite number of more. Who knows? But he put forth that every living organism, and the difference between the living and the dead is the prevalence of enzymatic activity. That's a big difference between rocks and people, or rocks and plants.
And heartbeats.
Exactly. So that's an interesting component. Now, enzymes they're such unique units. A lot of people don't even understand how they work exactly. They appear to do quantum tunneling. They have a chemical process. They have a biological process. They're fascinating units that every living organism manufactures and use to speed up or accelerate various chemical reactions inside the body. And that allows us to respond to our environments faster and better. And that's why typically when you have a child, a baby, like a small child, they recover from scrapes, cuts, bruises, bumps, things like that, much better than, say, a senior citizen. What Hall discovered is he tested with a variety of, and you can go into the research on his book, his other book that was Food Enzymes for Health and Longevity. And what he found is that when he would test various species, that he would feed them an enzymatically deficient diet, and I'll talk about what that is in a minute, that by the second and third generations, by the time they got to third generation, there were some interesting things that started to happen. Number one, the animals started to exert strange sociological behaviors. So sociological behaviors that were outside the normal for that species. And that could be as extreme as weird behavior patterns, eating feces that they wouldn't have normally done, or actually killing their own young, which was another one on an extreme level, very radical stuff. And the other thing was, is they started to demonstrate a higher prevalence of genetic illnesses and a inability to procreate. In other words, the species would either come out mutated, or they would come out stillborn, or they were literally sterile. Now, I found that kind of interesting because he actually predicted, or I think it was in the 50s, he actually, with the advent of chemicalization and monoculture and industrialization kind of be widespread around the world for food production, that he predicted that there was going to be a lot of genetic-based illnesses and a retraction of procreation. And I thought, wow, well, here we are in, 2019. I see birth clinics everywhere. I know all sorts of people who are having trouble having children. I see an absolutely exponential scaling up of genetic-based illnesses that the population is suffering from. And so my question is, I wonder if it's because you see very low birth rates in industrialized nations, and part of that is economic, but part of it's education. But I do believe part of it is actually the actual health and vitality of the people in that environment. In other words, they eat too much of the wrong stuff, too little of the good stuff, and then the pressures of that society often economically make childbearing happen later in life. So the idea was, is he suggested that you had a limited enzymatic pool. Now every species on the planet eats their food in a live, raw state. So a tiger knocks down a zebra, it eats the entrails or the enzymes and probiotics there, then it eats the carcass. A horse will find the most enzymatically rich grasses, it'll eat sprouts and these type of things, or things that are just come up because it has a high enzymatic potency. If a killer whale eats a seal, it consumes it or entirely. Now, humans are the only species that actually cooks their food. And when you cook your food, you destroy all the enzymes. So what happens is, if you look at human organisms related to any other species, we have a pancreas that is 4.5 times the size of any other species relative to body weight. And the production of enzymes in the body is what I would say a very metabolically expensive process. In that, we'll look at athleticism as a great example because I come from that world. And a high performance, like if you look at football athletes, 28 years old is after that, almost no running back can maintain their level of performance. And I'll get to where I'm going with this in a second. That's a position that requires a lot of explosiveness, a lot of strength. It takes a lot of damage and requires a lot of recovery. Well, enzymatic protease reduction inside the body really starts to taper off at 28 as proteins become, there's other enzymatic processes that are much more important than recovering. And so you have almost no athletes that are able to maintain their performance levels over the age of 28. Now, if you look similarly, if you look at the recovery levels of, say, athletes at a young age, you put them on proteolytic enzymes, for example, and they heal from cuts. There's research where karate fighters are recovering what would take 15 days to 2 weeks to recover. They're recovering in, 24 to 48 hours from using enzymatic supplements that involve protease, for example. And so you can apply that. What I believe is that there are fields of, I think the body always works on efficiency, and that when you take in enzymes, that if you're not using them particularly for digestion, you're going to use them for other things. And then there's also what I call the turkey dinner syndrome. It's another one that we've all went through. You have Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner, and you consume this mass amount of calories. You have the extra pie from grandma and the whole nine yards, and then everybody's kind of sprinting for the living room where, Uncle Bob is passed out on the couch and Aunt Mary, she goes back in the rocking chair, and the kids are lying on the floor, drool running down their mouth. And you're thinking of, well, if I just put all this food, if food conversion was just as simple as converting that into energy units or building blocks, I should be able to eat that turkey dinner and go out and run a marathon because I've just got enough calories to do it. It's not about that. It's your ability to actually convert those foods into usable energy units. And that is directly determined by the enzymes present in your food, the enzymes present in your body, and the state of your digestive situation, which includes the microbiome and peristaltic contraction, the whole nine yards. And we've disrupted that in the modern world almost to a point that I don't even know if it's recoverable for most people. In fact, I don't think it is for most people. And that's why I'm a big advocate of using supplemental enzymes, certainly in a short term, but for most people, they find that long-term usage has a variety of benefits that they don't want to go without.
Oh, well, now I'm kind of sold. And given that it's biohacking month over here on our side of the country, I'm going to have to give this a go. Do you cycle on and off them or do you stay on them consistently?
You know, I have literally been on digestive enzymes since 2004 when my health got compromised. Now, I have taken periods of time where I've gone on complete fasts. And so periodically, I'll do a 10-day water fast where I actually don't consume anything, no supplements, no anything, just water. And I do that periodically as a reset of my system. And I think it's awesome to do. First off, it changes your relationship with food and you recognize it's not as necessary, not a necessity as you want. I think another thing, it's a good opportunity to just let all the bodies recover. Because anytime that you don't eat, if you look at all species, when you stop eating, or when a species is sick, almost everybody doesn't want to eat. Well, why is that? I believe that it's because you're not digesting all your enzymatic power to break down the food. You're actually using those enzymes to go and repair the essential components inside our bodies. And I do believe that's one of the reasons why intermittent fasting is starting to catch on as a methodology for health. I think it's whether it's an unconscious or subconscious recognition of that we're eating too much, we need to give our digestive system a break. And that break has valuable components of repairing the digestive system. I think limiting the amount of enzymatic production that's going into digestion is another advantage of it. And then, all the benefits of resetting your apostat for, satiety and things like that.
Okay, wait, I'm going to play around with it. And I'm going to report back to everyone on how I feel. We've all heard that mindset has a huge influence on our ability to be effective and amplify in this world. But what if I told you your brain biochemistry, literally the neurotransmitters that are existing within your nervous system, can help amplify your mindset or your capacity to be effective? They can help accelerate your mission in the world. More and more with both my coaching clients and my patients, we end up having a conversation related to our own ability to control our nervous system through the optimization of neurotransmitters. Now, what the heck do I mean by this? The foods that you eat, the way that you think, your interaction with the world has the capacity to increase things like serotonin or dopamine, some of these really important neurotransmitters to helping you be effective and operate at your best. After listening to literally thousands of conversations with my clients and with my patients, I pulled together a very quick checklist so that you could have a better understanding of the things you're doing every single day to amplify your nervous system or downregulate it in a way that isn't necessarily serving your mission. If you want access to this information and want to learn a little bit more about how you can optimize your brain health for success, visit meganwalker.com/brainhealth to grab your handout now. Now, back to our episode. I feel like this is actually a perfect place to make a transition in the interview. And we have a second component of the interview. And I have a series of rapid fire questions for you. I call these our KPIs. So just like we have them with respect to our businesses, I believe we have them in how we live our lives as well. So I've got a few questions for you, if you'll indulge me for a second here.
Oh, this sounds like fun. I'm up for it.
I know. Take a deep breath. Here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
First one, who is inspiring you right now?
Buddha.
Huh, I like it. Haven't heard that one before. What is your audacious goal for the next year?
Jeez, that's a good one. I mean, I have so many audacious goals.
You
guess
can have more than one.
My audacious goal is actually moving to California, which I've been worked on for quite some time and just got approval.
Oh, that's exciting. Good one.
Yeah.
What is the one thing you are most consistent with respect to your health?
Exercise.
What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
I don't even know if I can say that.
do tell.
I, at one point in time, I lived a very nefarious lifetime and kind of the underworld and did all sorts of wild and crazy things, I guess. So.
Okay, there's bona fide badass in there. What do you do for fun?
Yeah.
We'll just leave the rest to podcast number two. What do you do for fun or play?
That's a good one. Meditation would be probably my greatest thing. And it doesn't really fit inside of that, but it's the thing that I feel the best at. And then the second thing, I'm really into reading. So kind of boring.
What kind of things? What kind of things do you read?
I read everything from, like, right now I'm into the Harari books. And Yuval Noah Harari, the guy that wrote Sapiens and 21 Lessons for the 21st Century and all that sort of stuff. So I'm into that. I'm into kind of spiritual traditions, and I'm into geopolitics as well as economics. So kind of wide, various things. And I think that's probably the thing I get the most juice out of learning from experts from other areas that I can oftentimes draw inference and applications to my life.
Yeah, love it. Last question for you. Entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I think we learn to become them. Some people I think are innately driven that way, but I think it has more to do with their environment. And either you become your environment or you react against it. And so I became an entrepreneur out of reacting against it as opposed to kind of falling into it, which some of my friends who are, you know, multi-generational entrepreneurs.
I love it. I never get the same answer for that particular question. Wade, you are an abundance of knowledge. I know you've got your own podcast and a ton of things that you are contributing to the world with respect to health and wellness. Where can we send people to learn more about what you're up to?
Yeah. So if you go to bioptimizers.com/entropology, so we're going to put that slash in there. Yeah. You go there. And what happens is you can jump on. I've got actually a 12-week course where I go into 84 different topics, 5 to 15-minute videos of everything I've learned in health and who I learned it from, and just summarize it in a way that's easy, digestible, and people can kind of take that on. That's our company, Bioptimize. We're our digestive health company, but we really focus on education so that people don't just supplement their way out of a situation. They actually learn the practices and principles that I've spent my entire life learning. And then, of course, if people go there, they can go to put in podcast 10 and they'll get 10% off any of our products if they so choose to try them.
Amazing. We can all talk about how our life has changed on enzymes.
You got it.
Awesome. Wade, thank you so much for your time. I can't thank you enough for being here.
Thanks, Megan. Great to be here.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.